Accession number 9434, reel 16.
During this advance, did you think this was the end of the war? Did you think you were winning, or were there any signs that you were winning?
Oh, yes, there were definite signs. The advance was so steady, you see. The advance was steady, and when we'd passed the old March front line, and were getting into what had been German territory for the whole of the war, it was obvious that something was giving. You see,
well, in what way was it obvious? Why?
Well, it was obvious because the fighting had become less intense. It became more sporadic. You see, and there were no trench systems. It was all in the open. The trenches that the Germans dug. We'd already passed the famous Hindenburg line. That Hindenburg line was stormed on the 30th of September by the, or near the 30th, by the infantry. And once they'd broken that, there were no real defences behind it, you see. They were all improvised, just improvised trenches. The fighting became more open country.
Now, you'd been used to trench warfare for 4 years. How did you find open warfare?
Well, we were horsed. And we could get about, but it was encouraging, you see, because the signs were that there weren't going to be any more standstill, you know, the same place for months, being shelled and the other being shelled and shelling them. Obviously, the war was in the open country now, and the resistance, although it was still pretty useful, nothing like what it was in the days when the German army was at its best.
Well, did you see any signs of collapse in the sense of a lot of German prisoners or anything like
that?
Well,
we saw prisoners, yes. They used to come streaming through the lines. And one day, a party came streaming past me. I was mounted. And I saw the German wounded were still laying about on the ground, you see. And so I stopped them and yelled out Krankenträger to them, which is the stretcher bearer in German, and pointed to some stretchers on one of the ambulances which had caught up with us, and set them to work carrying back. And they did it very quickly and efficiently. But I pointed to their own wounded, you see. We were looking after our wounded. I pointed to their own wounded who were still laying on the ground there in small clusters.
Were you dealing with a lot of casualties during this period?
Dealing with getting them back, you see. I wasn't doing much dressing.
Were there a lot of them, though?
They weren't in heaps. There were steady numbers, you know. There's always somebody getting needing treatment, but most of them were directed back to the field ambulance.
Now, as we move into October, I believe you received the offer of a commission in October. It didn't come off, but could you explain exactly what happened?
Well, what happened was early in October, the first week it would be, I was ordered to go back to army headquarters, one of the army headquarters, and be interviewed by Major General Manus O'Keefe, Royal Army Medical Corps, who was the Director of Medical Services for the Fifth Army. And I went back. The idea was, you see, the casualties among medical officers had been absolutely horrific. You see, they were sitting ducks. Every battalion had one, and every unit had one. And in battle, they were sitting ducks, and they were, the casualties among them were very, very high. And in fact, they were being lost, killed and wounded so faster than they could retrain replacements in Great Britain. And so the idea was that experienced NCOs like myself, who'd been doing first aid treatment on the battlefield during the war, would be commissioned and take the place of the medical officer with battalions and regiments in order to save the qualified doctors for units a bit farther back. And I was interviewed on that basis.
What sort of interview was it?
It was quite short. My record was in front of him. He was examining it and saw it. And then he turned and asked me what my father was. And I told him he was a builder, and sometimes a builder's labourer. That more or less concluded the interview, I think. I don't think he thought I was... I might be all right myself, but my family wasn't commission-ranked material.
How did you react to that?
No, I thought... I just took it in my stride.
Did you want to be an officer?
No, not particularly. I didn't mind. I couldn't care. I didn't bother. I could have done the job, but I wasn't... it wasn't an overweening ambition of mine.
So, after the interview, you went back to your normal role?
I went back to normal role, yes.
Now, what happened as you moved into October then? Where were you moving
to? Well, we were moving east all the time, October, and when we got into November, the signs were obvious. The resistance, the German resistance was really crumbling now, and we got into November, and we were steadily advancing each day, and until on when it came to about a couple of days before the Armistice Day, it rained, it was wet, and then after that, it turned frosty, and on Armistice morning, I remember the fog was, it was a Monday morning, November the 11th, the fog was so thick that visibility was down to 10 yards. And as we moved and moved on, we found ourselves about 10 o'clock that morning, we were up with the infantry patrols. And of course, that's where when we found out that they were the farthest, closest to the Germans, we stopped. And we stood in that place until it must have been all half past 12, 1 o'clock, before the order was given to retire. A silence came over the whole place that you could almost feel, you know, after 4.5 years of war, not a shot was being fired, not a sound was heard, because the fog blanketed everything, you see, and hung very thickly over northeast. We were northeast of Mons, whereas I'd started the battle 4.5 years before, southeast of Mons. But there I was back where the war had started after 4.5, nearly 4.5 years of it.
How did you react to the armistice?
No?
How did you react to
Well, it was one of relief, of course. The idea that we should never come under fire again was one of relief, it was almost taking off two heavy overcoats. In a humid atmosphere, you know, one felt tremendous relief.
Did you celebrate at all?
Well, the terms of the armistice were that there had to be 6 miles between the German troops and our advance. And every day they moved back into Germany and we moved after them, but there was always 6 miles between the two armies, you see. Well, now, that night we moved, because we were closer than 6 miles to them, we moved back into Mons itself, and were billeted. And you know, that evening, the good people of Mons, they came round to our field ambulance, they came round to us, and they took us in sixes and fours into their homes, and they gave us the meal of a lifetime. They dug up, they told us that they dug up out of their gardens all the food and the wine they'd buried 4.5 years before, when the Germans entered Mons in 1914, they buried as much food and wine as they could in their back gardens, you see. And they dug it all up and gave us a tremendous spread.
So the reception from the people of Mons was very friendly.
Tremendous, tremendous, tremendous.
So this was the only celebrations that went... this was the celebrations for you, then?
Yes, the only celebration, because the following day... we rested, and we went back again the following evening for another meal. But those 2 days were the only days of rest we had, because on the third day we started moving forward into Germany.
I believe you also had some sort of entertainment show on at the theatre, the Army Entertainment School. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, on the evening of the second day there,
in Mons,
after the on the 12th of November, the army had got the entertainers up and the comedians and the music hall artists, and they'd taken over theatre in Mons and gave us a first-class entertainment. We all enjoyed that immensely.
What sort of thing was it?
Oh, there was jugglers, singers, jugglers, short act, one-act plays, you know. A really lovely evening.
Were there any famous musical stars, or were they just...
Well, they were the run-of-the-mill star. I remember one, the famous juggler, the long fellow, I forget his name now, but he was about 6 feet five, and with a tremendous long arm, and he was a comic figure in himself. And he was a top-of-the-bill juggling act in Great Britain.
So, now, the next day, on the 13th, then, you went forward into Germany.
Yep.
Was that what you expected to do, or how did you react to that?
Well, we expected that we would do that because, you see, the cavalry were the advance guard of the army, of occupation, and they were the cavalry who crossed the frontier first and dug the bridgeheads the other side of the Rhine, and we started to move on. Every day we moved on a bit, and we crossed the frontier eventually on the 1st of December.
Did your supplies keep pace with you?
I regret to tell you, very greatly regret to tell you, that after the armistice, we had no supplies up for 5 days, including the day after the armistice, for the first time in the whole war, we were let down because everybody was obviously celebrating behind the line, and they'd forgotten that there was such a thing as an advance as a front line army. I made inquiries of a cavalry regiment, and he said, the chap told me, it's just the same here. He says, we're on our iron rations, on our last reserve rations, which lasted for 5 days before we got more supplies. It was bully beef and dog biscuits, of course, nothing else. And water. Bully beef, dog biscuits and water. And the great trouble was that this time, the famous so-called influenza, which was really a pneumonic plague, had started to spread through the world, and some good men who had lasted through the war, or most of the war, some of them, died as a result of not being able to get better rations. And what they did was they went into the civilian houses and drank up all the wine they could lay their hands on, and they had their resistance lowered, and when they were attacked by the plague, in 2 days they were dead. We lost 4 men in the field ambulance. They were taken ill, athletic men, taken ill in the evening, and were dead the next day. Pneumonia.
Did you catch it at all?
No, I never caught it. I hadn't, and I had great belief in my own strength. I never caught it, and I went right through the advance to the Rhine, and never had. All I had was a slight sore throat, which was easily treated.
You were a medical man. Were there any preventative measures that you were either told to do or thought of for yourself?
You couldn't. There was no preventative measure possible for this so-called influenza. It was a virus, I believe a virus, and it killed more people all over the world than were lost in the war. South America was devastated by it, and ships at sea, it was even caught by ships at sea.
Now, as you advance, you'd be going through, through into Belgium and such like. How did the civilian population react? They'd been, after Mons, I mean, they'd been under German control for 4 or 5 years.
Very quietly. There were no demonstrations. flag waving turnouts. Very quietly, they just welcomed us. You see, they were so far back behind the battle lines there that it hadn't changed their lines a lot. They were agricultural people, and you know, it was seed time to harvest for them, just the same as if there hadn't been a war. They had to carry on their lives.
You mentioned that some of the men went into houses and took wine. Would that be looting of any sort, or
no,
was that offered to them?
No, they went in and they were offered it, and of course they asked for more, and they were given it, and they drank, having eaten nothing really to eat properly, only the ration of the emergency ration of biscuits and bully beef. They just couldn't take it. You see, they got loaded up with the wine and fell victims to the bug.
When did you cross the German frontier?
We crossed it on the 1st of September, 1st of December, at rather to the north. And we crossed it, and the first thing I saw there was a man in uniform, a German in uniform. He walked up to a door of a house in the street, and it was opened by a woman who closed it again, and he knocked again, and she opened it again. She had an axe in her hand. There were no laurels for the defeated army there. She was obviously one of these German Amazons who determined to give no welcome to the defeated husband.
What did you think of that? That must have caused some amusement, I suppose.
Well, it caused some amusement because the troops thought, well, here, well, thank God the English women are not like that.
What was the German response in this first, as you went on to bomb? How did the German civilians react to you?
Well, I noticed all the way through they put up an enormous display of welcome for their own troops. They had placards, displays at every railway station. In every town there was a great display welcoming home their own defeated army. And as for us, well, they just accepted us. They thought that we were going to do much more plundering than they expected. You see, as a matter of fact, there was no plundering because we brought our own rations with us. And they, unfortunately, had none to spare. They were very short of food, the Germans.
So what would you describe their attitude as? Civil or cold or indifferent?
It was quite indifferent. And in some places, even warm. I never had any difficulty in getting what I wanted, if it was there, available, and not causing deprivation to the people I took it from.
Did you come into contact with any representatives of the German military, by the border for guards or just German army units? Did you see any of them?
No, we never saw them at all. Never saw sight of them. The only thing that happened while I was there was. They were allowed, apparently, the Allies allowed the ex-German soldiers in civilian clothes to form their equivalent of the British Legion. And they did that for political purposes. You see, Germany was rife with Bolshevism and communism at the end of the war. And so it was decided that the German army, the men who got home, should be allowed to join their sort of old comrades associations, and in fact they had a march and a band through the village that we were billeted in. We took no notice of them, and did the goose step. We took no notice of them. They were ex-soldiers getting together in the same as the British Legion would do.
Was this the Free Corps or Freikorps?
Huh?
Was this the Free Corps?
No, it was a sort of old comrades association sort of affair. You know. At that time, it wasn't an aggressive body, although it did turn out later on that they turned that way.
Right, so when you crossed, you went to bomb the German frontier. Where did you go to? Where did you go from Bonn?
Well, we crossed the Rhine at Bonn, and the salute was taken by Major General, by General, Sir Arthur Currie, the Commander-in-Chief of the Canadian Forces. He took the salute, and, you know, in England at the time, there'd been a popular song called When We Wind Up the Watch on the Rhine. And there were all the troops winding up their watches, going over, crossing over the bridges. I had no watch, but it made me laugh because they were all simple fellows and they were winding up their watch going over the Rhine. And we went, I think it was a place called Siegburg.
Where's that near?
Siegburg, that's out in front of Bonn, where the cavalry were digging the salient. You see, they dug a great salient in front of Bonn and Cologne in order to protect the occupied area.
It's like a bridgehead.
It was a bridgehead, yes. A very large bridgehead, too.
You weren't involved in the digging, of course.
No, not involved in the digging, no. I was quartered in Siegburg, I think it was Siegburg, and with nothing to do.
You had no duties?
No. Well, I had duties, but there were no customers, you see.
So, where did you go from Siegburg?
Well, we went from Siegburg, we went back through Cologne, and to a village about 20 or 15 miles from Cologne called Heppendorf. And there we stayed over Christmas, we stayed until the following September.
And what exactly were you doing during this time? What were you doing during this time?
We were doing nothing. We were just doing routine parades, you know, parade in the morning, inspection, any drills necessary. You've got to remember, at that time, most of the personnel of the field ambulance had been turned right over. We now had reinforcements, most of the personnel, of 18, 19-year-olds. Would come out there and had to be trained, and most of my time was taken up training.
Was this in an official capacity training or informally?
Oh no, it was official capacity training them in the work of a Royal Army Medical Corps man on the battlefield. The same sort of tuition I'd had myself.
What sort of billet were you in at Heppendorf and earlier at Siegburg?
Oh, we were billeted on the local population in their homes. And we were given a room. I had a very small room in Heppendorf. It was about six feet by 3 feet, with a bunk bed. But it was something which was after 4.5 years, nearly 4.5 years of sleeping on the ground, it was a luxury.
How did you get on with the German, the billet owners?
Oh, they were very good. He was a small farmer, the man I was billeted with, and he had two daughters, and the elder one was quite friendly, and as a matter of fact, she washed all my smalls for me. Quite friendly.
So they weren't much different from any other billeted?
No, they wasn't. I must say that the young men in Heppendorf didn't take very kindly to us going there, you see. We were all, well, our uniforms were all, of course, cleaned up and smartened up, and we were polishing our buttons by then, and we were well turned out. And one morning, we came down, and on the village pump was written a message in German. It took 4.5 years for the brave British troops to conquer the German army. But they conquered the girls of Heppendorf in one night. That was, I think, a bit of an exaggeration, but there was no doubt about it. The attitude of the females in Heppendorf towards our troops in general was a very friendly one. I think a few bars of chocolate exchanged hands. Well, one day a cart came into the village. And all the young men got into it, and then they started to sing a song, which shows you they were still not prepared to accept the attitude of the girls. And they started singing this song, Lustig sind die Rhenische Mädchen, Faria, Faria all, Gien spazieren mit Tommy Soldatchen, Faria Faria O. Fünf Minuten Promenade vor einer Tafel Schokolade, Faria 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 O, Faria Faria O. It was they were complaining that the girls in English, you know, they were, you understand it, you know, the Heppendorf girls were merry, and they went for a walk with the British soldiers for a slab of chocolate, you see.
Was there any actual friction with the young men? Did it actually go further than this sort of?
Yes, there was one incident when one night the oldest man in our unit was attacked by some young fellows there coming down the road. They just pushed him around and roughed him up. And when he came in, he got a few bruises. And I looked at him and I said, all right, who were they? And he said, they walked off in the direction of the end of the village. So I said, all right. So I got I got three Army Service Corps drivers, rifle and bayonet. I took a rifle and bayonet myself. And I went. I asked a question where in the village where they were likely to live. And I found it. And I went out and knocked at the door of the house where these young lads were. It was midnight. I hauled them out of bed, got them to get dressed, marched them back into the village, and I stuck them in a room for the rest of the night, and then handed them over to the local burgomaster the following morning with a warning to him. I said, look, if this happens again, I said, there'll be trouble. You deal with them, you discipline these boys, because they're only about 16. You discipline them. And he did. He says, thank you very much. He says, I will. He says, it's disgraceful. They should attack a man. He was about 42, you see this, yeah. And that was the only incident antagonistic to us that I remember in the whole time we were there.
How many people were billeted in Heppendorf?
Oh, there were only us, only the field ambulance, about 50 of us.
So you'd be one of the senior NCOs.
I was the staff sergeant, and we had a regimental sergeant major, quartermaster sergeant, and I was the staff sergeant.
What were your duties as staff sergeant?
Well, my duties as staff sergeant were general discipline. Taught as much as I knew myself to this young entry, because they were most of the personnel in the ambulance field ambulance then were young reinforcements, and it was more or less a training job all the time.
What sort of recreations would you have?
Now and again, one of the sergeants was quite good in this direction, and he arranged one. We played football, of course. We got a football field, and we played football. And one night he arranged a trip to Cologne to see Lohengrin in the Cologne Opera House, which was very, very finely sung and put on. I remember that. I thought myself, fancy this nation, this great German nation, stooping to war when they have such marvellous traditions as this.
Did you see much of the sights of the surrounding countryside? Because they've got a lot of castles and things in that area.
What I did see, one day, Miss Ashwell, sister of Lena Ashwell, the famous actress, she came in. And she was organising a trip up the Rhine.
In what capacity?
Representing the Army Entertainments Committee, you see. She was an official representative of the committee to entertain the occupying troops. And she organised this trip up the Rhine, and I very gladly accepted the offer to go, because it gave me the opportunity to see all the river from Cologne right down to Bingen, up to Bingen, and all those marvellous castles perched, Grimm's fairy tale castles perched on the hillside all the way down the river. And of course, on the left bank of the Cologne, on the right bank as it goes to the sea, and on the left bank as you go up.